Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the place where you can still hear libertarian analysis and content about the news, brought to you by the magazine Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by the core three of Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy almost fall, everyone.
Matt. Yeah.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Matt, yeah. I think
the
that's
core
my,
three.
The core three of freedom. Yeah, the freedom
I
of
like,
freedom.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Diggity. I'm looking forward to
at least
to
you
your
didn't
next...
say the threesome of freedom. That's
should be the core four, really, though, Matt.
Yeah. You know? No. This is Matt Welch and the core three, right? Okay. This is Matt Welch is our front man.
I'm not like Jay the
Mysterious One.
I'm Sam Sham, and you're the Pharaohs.
You got Catherine on the marimba.
You are Wooly Bully.
Listen, we're going to get to a lot of news here in a moment, but first, friends, I've got one word for you. Senolytics. That's right. Senolytics is a category of ingredients discovered over the past decade that could be a bombshell for promoting healthy aging and enhancing your physical prime, if that's even possible with Nick Gillespie, which it's not. Here's how senolytics work. As we age, everyone, even Nick Gillespie and Tom Brady, accumulates senescent cells in their body. Senescent cells cause symptoms of aging, such as aches and discomfort. I guess I'm aging. Slow workout recovery, sluggish mental and physical energy. These zombie cells are old and worn out, and they're taking up space and nutrients from your healthy cells. But now you can prune these dead cells off the limbs of your tree of life by taking Qualia Senolytic. Qualia Senolytic is a vegan, gluten-free, non-GMO supplement, and you only need to take it twice a month to remove those zombie cells and halt the barbarians of aging from the cellular gates. To resist aging at the cellular level, just go to qualialife.com/roundtable to get up to 50% off and use the code roundtable at checkout for an additional 15% off. That's qualialife.com/roundtable. Or just go to whatever GNC location in your neighborhood and look for Qualia Senolytic. By whatever means, do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. We're 2 months out from Election Day. And there's been what feels, to me anyway, like this weird outbreak of federal investigations involving foreign country influence in American political affairs in New York, where two of us live. We're going to leave that up to you to guess. Mayor Eric Adams has seen basically his entire senior leadership team have their phones seized and their homes ransacked by the FBI as part of one of three different corruption investigations being engineered by our good friends over at the Southern District of New York. That was sarcasm. This particular investigation is reportedly looking into Adams's possibly illegal activity, receiving money and doing favors for the country of Turkey. There's another probe examining his ties to Red China. Speaking of which, New York Governor Kathy Hochul, fresh off her thrilling speaking performance at the Democratic National Convention, that was also sarcasm, had her deputy chief of staff, Linda Sun, indicted, along with Linda Sun's husband, last week on 10 counts stemming from doing Chinese bidding for cash. And in a case that's attracting the most attention, that we'll talk about the most, probably, mostly because it's kind of hilarious. A federal indictment unsealed last week alleged that a Tennessee-based conservative podcasting company you'd never heard of called Tenet Media was the recipient of 10 million smackaroonies worth of illegally transmitted money from shadowy Ruskies who were eager to boost the anti-Ukrainian content and other such like from political influencers, including Dave Rubin, Benny Johnson, and Tim Pool. All of whom said they had no idea and that those $100,000 per video contracts were just like normal market levels for their work. These cases are not related, as far as we know, at least, though most of them involve the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA, which, fun fact, was passed in 1938 to tamp down or counter alleged unlabeled Nazi propaganda. Anyways, Catherine... FARA was very rarely used until Donald Trump became the president. And then suddenly the Justice Department got very excited about having RT Russia Today, which some of us have been on over the years, but not anytime recently, labeled as a foreign agent of some sort in China Daily and so forth. Does your libertarian spidey sense get all tingly when you see the feds dropping high-profile investigations of partisan media just before a highly contested election?
Yes, my spidey senses are tingling. There's a couple things going on here. One is...
Is that because Dr. Octopus is standing right behind you?
If you're Dr. Octopus, then yes. One thing that's going on here is we just desperately want the absolute garbage that is our current electoral situation to be someone else's fault. Like, it's like, oh, maybe it's the Ruskies. Maybe it's the red Chinese. And the fact is, like, that all of this mess is of our own making. Not only our political situation, but also the situation in our media, just more broadly. Like, oh, these really bad takes make sense if someone was paying for them. No, they don't. Those bad the money followed the bad takes, if anything, in almost all of these cases. And so I think that's something that's always worth keeping in mind, just in general, actually, when people say, you know, oh, you know, this this position, this policy position or this editorial position was bought and paid for. Occasionally that does happen, but far more likely the money goes to amplify and support pre-existing opinions. I don't love the idea of some law from the 30s deciding who, you know, does and doesn't get to support a certain media organization. On the other hand, it does seem like a lot of these cases are pretty gross. It seems like they're definitely foreign agents trying to change the outcomes of our elections. So I get why there is a kind of general outrage about them.
Can I slightly dispute one of the phrase there at the very end, that they're trying to change the outcomes of our election? I don't think that's exactly wrong, but I think that it's just more that they're trying to influence American opinion, and in particular, American right-wing opinion, American sort of MAGA right opinion. They want to shape it in a specific way. And while that might have electoral consequences, I don't think that the best way to think, like, people want this to be election interference. And it's
opinion
not,
interference.
It's election adjacent, of course, because all political opinion is election adjacent. But this is not election interference in the sense of hacking into voting machines, in the sense of changing vote counts, in the sense of, like, actually directly mucking with what is going on when people go to a voting booth and cast a vote and make those decisions. This is a sort of... This is a speech adjacent thing that is, that of course has some relevance to elections just because it's political opinions.
Nick, if I may just, it's also not simply right wing stuff. As Matt was talking about, you know, Kathy Hochul is a Democrat, and the Chinese government was pushing to kind of ice out Taiwan from even being mentioned in New York City or New York State, or to get any kind of contracts and stuff like that. And, you know, the South Korean government was massaging various bald heads at the Washington Post, and, you know, not on the right. So it's more than that. Matt, to your larger question, one of the biggest outrages that I think legacy media and the left-wing media, or that's a stupid term, left-leaning media, hasn't reckoned with is the complete wrongness of the Russiagate narrative going back to Trump. And, you know, to the extent that there is a deep state, the FBI and the intelligence services are all still seem to be committed, even when there are people that Trump appointed, to the idea that Russia somehow, you know, screwed with our, you know, wonderful election system in 2016. And it's just not true. I mean, every investigation has shown it not to be true, but it's something that people desperately want to be true. So they keep peddling this kind of stuff.
There were those Facebook memes.
Yeah, no, and it was, you know, there were literally dozens of people who showed up at various events in order to, you know, fight on both sides of the street in Texas. And this, you know, to Catherine's point, like, we go through waves of conspiracy, like, where America just doesn't want to take responsibility for our own stupidity. And we're in simultaneously one of the dumbest moments in our political history. And there's an absolute abnegation of saying, you know what, like, maybe Americans elected Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton sucks so bad. Maybe we are facing the dumbest election at least since 2020 because of America, and it's not outside interference. I worry about this kind of being weaponized. You know, this, Matt, why is it realistic to think there's more monkeying around that matters going on now than there was during the Cold War or something like that? Like, of course, all of these FARA prosecutions are politically motivated because that statute is a massive blanket and it gets leveled. You know, this is the Matt Welch metaphor.
Yeah,
very unevenly across, you know, across things. It is so, you know, kind of arbitrary. Anybody can be brought up on almost any moment, and it's just it's bullshit.
Nick, are you asking that we level the blanket playing field?
Yes,
is that what you're like calling that. For? Okay. Okay,
Catherine, building on Nick's.
Actually, let's get rid of the playing field. It's not a game.
We're just going to play on the blanket.
Help me, Matt, please.
Build on the Russiagate for a second here. And if I keep talking, maybe Peter will stop. It was basically 4 years ago, next month, October, mid-October, like 2 weeks before the election, that more than 50 intelligence officers signed a joint letter saying that the Hunter Biden laptop story has, quote, all the classic earmarks of a Russian information operation. This past weekend on C-SPAN's Book TV, interviewed Joel Pollack from Breitbart. He has a book called The Agenda, What Trump Should Do in His First 100 Days. And one of his proposals that caught my interest, besides national bike lanes, which is pretty interesting, but was that all of those people who signed that letter should have their security clearances revoked. I'm like, yeah, that sounds, what the hell was that? Yes, I'm just going to throw it at you agree with me that that's terrible.
Everyone seems really bad at their jobs. This is the thing that I'm just struck by in so many of these conversations.
Hey, my review isn't for another day.
Yeah, it is. It is annual review season at Reason, and I don't want anyone to take that the wrong way. But in these various alleged conspirators, even the most competent among them still seem to make really, really stupid errors. And so I'm thinking here of in the Kathy Hochul story. One of the bribes was a series of Nanjing-style salted ducks prepared by a Chinese consulate official's private chef. Like, somebody's just getting fancy Chinese ducks delivered to their house on the regular, and everyone's like, seems normal, let's do it. Also, a lot of expensive purses. Like, if I personally was receiving illegal money from a foreign government, I don't know that I would spend it on a highly visible status symbol with a known price that is well above what I could reasonably afford on my salary as a public official or as a minor media personality. And it's just like a weird, it's like those people who are, maybe we're just catching the people that are bad at it. And I do think that's always a legitimate theory. But likewise with the Hunter Biden laptop thing, I just assume that in fact people are pretty dumb and they were wrong, and not that this is, you know, some kind of elaborate fifth dimensional chess. But it is shocking to me.
Maybe I'm just totally making this up, but I recall reading that the woman who was indicted, who worked for Kathy Hochul, attended like a Communist Party gala,
yes,
celebrating like the 70th or whatever
she
anniversary.
She flew to China.
Yes,
stayed in China. At a fancy hotel and
with
attended like the biggest party of the year for the commies, and everyone was like, "Oh, seems fine." And then she was like, "Let's delete all mentions of Taiwan and the Uyghurs from every press release that comes out of the governor's office," and everyone was like, "Yeah." Sure.
Matt, what's your sense of things with the Farah prosecutions? Because it is like, you know, it seems totally politically motivated, not, you know, in some very basic way. And like, how do you think, you know, the fact that it includes people who are in the media, whether it's alternative media or legacy media, it's like, it does seem like it's an attempt to punish people, right? That are doing journalisms.
Farah used to be the kind of RICO of Washington. I forget one of the ones that was also used in the during the Trump administration that everyone was hoping to emoluments. We're going to get the emoluments put them all over Trump. Like it was a thing that people threatened, and almost nobody, except if they were super big stoners who couldn't fill out paperwork and working for certain right wing governments in the former communist Eastern Europe, that no one would get prosecuted under Farah, which is just basically like, are you a lobbyist? Okay, you got to fill out paperwork. Usually it would be like civil penalties. It just wasn't something that was used very much. And now we're using it to kind of go after state-sponsored media. And there's a lot of state-sponsored media. Remember those guys who used to come in the office sometimes from press TV. Right?
I have no memory of that.
Yeah, of course you don't. They got to you. Yeah. Put you in the chair.
Where were they from? Like what country?
Iran. They're Iranian-backed state media, press TV. I think that the prosecutions clearly since 2017 have been based on this kind of sense that we need to more accurately label state-sponsored media, and then actual corrupt activities such as the Kathy Hochul deputy secretary. I've got no problem with going after someone who's looking like they're acting like a spy, right? Like, you should be able to have some counter spy stuff, but like the pressure on media, there's been, you know, moves to get RT banned, from the airwaves, which is completely idiotic as far as I'm
concerned. One of the things for the Tenet Media, and like, if I'm naming my shitty company after a Christopher Nolan movie, I'm going with Dark Knight or Dunkirk, not Tenet, which is the worst of all those movies. But I they paid for something on the order of like 2,000 videos that got, or 800 videos that got X number of views. I looked at it and it worked out to about 8,000 views per video that they were paying hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions of dollars for, from people like Dave Rubin and Tim Pool and Benny Johnson, who obviously nobody with a functioning brain takes Benny Johnson seriously. A plagiarist, a fabulist, a wonderful human being, I'll add as well. It doesn't work. I mean, Martin Gurry, the great former CIA analyst, Revolt of the Public author, had a tweet over the weekend where it's like, show me a time when a tweet or social media, you know, that is linked to a foreign government changed people's minds or changed their votes. And it just does not work that way. But both the right and the left want to believe desperately in this kind of old 1930s Frankfurt School model of, you know, Donald Duck gets his punishment in the movie so that international capital can throttle laborers. You know, it's so fundamentally stupid. I almost feel bad for extending this conversation.
Peter, before we button this conversation, the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, last week blocked the sale of U.S. steel to Nippon Steel, or the takeover of Nippon acquisition. I presume on the debate stage on Tuesday, which we'll talk about in a second here, we're going to see both candidates try to outdo one another in terms of tariffing Red China and whatnot. Should we look at this, these latest waves of prosecutions, the reignited interest in FARA, the cracking down on foreign media outlets and whatnot, and anyone who's associated with them? Is that sort of like just part of a bipartisan populism? Is this just what it looks like applied, and we're going to be in this moment for a long time? And if so, how awesome is it going to be?
I think that's definitely part of it. The neo-populist moment is real, and there is a horseshoe theory effect happening where both parties are sort of reorganizing themselves along these populist lines. You know, for a long time, there's been this critique of, Washington elites, they're just not like normal people because they believe in free markets and, you know, they're socially liberal, right? Which is, it's the libertarians, they're in charge. And one thing you can say these days is that the libertarians are not in charge.
Speak for
yourself.
They're
not the ones do it yet. Okay, so this libertarian is definitely not in charge. And part of that is a renewed, exaggerated fear of foreign influence and just foreigners generally. And you see that with the immigration debate. You see that with fears of China and Russia and all of this. And I think this is at least part of that. But it's also just an outgrowth of the security state's paranoia about Chinese and Russian influence, a paranoia that has been growing and has been increasingly evident since 2015 when Donald Trump stepped down that elevator. We have just seen so many cases in which the national security state has been like, well, yeah, we got, you know, it's the Russians who are like, do you guys remember the words Cambridge Analytica?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. So I would just, everyone freaked out about Cambridge Analytica and Facebook and this Steve Bannon's master plan to like mind manipulate the American electorate. And then they just didn't really bother to look at the after action reviews that they got published like by the British government and other places. It was like, there was nothing there. There was just absolutely nothing there at all, and we have seen that so many times. I do think that in the case of the Tenet Media case, it's not, there's nothing there. There really was some Russian money funding some American commentators. But, and I think there's even, like, you can make a kind of a quasi-libertarian case that actually that particular, this particular case is, look, we're against fraud. We're against money laundering, and we're for government transparency.
I think I'm in favor of.
At least two of those, right? And this is a case, and like what they're saying is you didn't disclose it, and you committed fraud against the people who you told were taking money from a fake. What was he?
They
like
all
a,
are. They're the
like,
victims.
Like a I made up Tim billionaire Pool's with a
was
with
like
a,
I'm the victim here. He right, had to interrupt a skateboarding session. When yeah. he got and texts made, about it.
They right. made they yeah. made like a fake LinkedIn. Like people definitely were yeah, lied
what
to.
What was the name of the guy that they said was the head of the company, Eduardo Caraccio or something like that? I mean, it was up there with like Ron Mexico.
Yeah.
It was so good at Carlos so Danger. It was like Eduardo Guarargio. Yeah.
Yeah, this morning on my way in
into like a billionaire from a Dan Brown novel.
It does sound like a Dan Brown novel. This morning on my way into work, I was listening to Megyn Kelly's podcast and she opens up by saying, hey, the last episode, we knew that the DOJ was going to release some information about something having to do with Russian interference. And we told you at the end of last week that we would have a commentator on to discuss it. And that commentator was Dave Rubin. So he won't be on today, but I want to emphasize that he was the victim here, too. And that was kind of her take on it. And it is true that those guys were very much lied to. Now, should their bullshit meters have been a little bit better calibrated?
Yeah. But then if Tim Pool had a good bullshit meter, he wouldn't be Tim Pool.
That's true.
Bridget Fetasy had a great tweet saying that she laughed herself to sleep on Friday night because all the people who keep screaming that everything is a psyop were part of a psyop, which I thought was very funny.
A lot of people throwing around the word psyop these days. As
I love
mentioned,
the psyop. You've
that's
gotta
a
love
scientific
a good psyop.
Operation.
Yes, nailed it.
Yeah. As teased on Tuesday, it's debate night in many ways, turns out. But the one that we care about the most as the listening public probably is Kamala Harris versus Donald Trump, thus ending the phony war period of the 2024 presidential election, which is still neck and neck. In the run-up to this big event, Kamala Harris, after 7 weeks of being the presumptive Democratic nominee, has finally published some actual words on her website's issues page. So that's pretty exciting. As part of our debate preview, let's go around the table real quick and discuss what we have discovered there on the issues of Kamala Harris. Catherine, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, she's going to make childcare really cheap, but also guarantee that all people providing childcare get paid an infinite number of dollars. So that should work out great.
Oh, good.
I do want to be clear that there doesn't seem to be a lot of daylight between her newly announced position and Donald Trump's pre-existing position, which is also that question mark, except for he's going to pay for it
through tariffs.
With tariffs.
Yeah.
Question mark. So, you know, that's where we're at. But it seems that it's sort of implied in that plank is that she will be abolishing the laws of supply and demand. So I look forward to seeing how that goes.
Peter, what did you find there of interest?
There's a passage titled Strengthen and Bring Down the Cost of Healthcare. And I just want to dwell on that for a moment. What are the words strengthen and doing? Is it strengthening the cost of healthcare?
Those costs are already pretty strong.
Strengthening the healthcare? I guess, is that like you're going to consume more protein and get like a, you know, bigger, you get a deadlift more? Like,
healthcare is getting swole, Peter.
Get some of those senolytics, you know?
That's right.
That's what's, I do not know what the words strengthen and are doing in that headline. Just like the editor in me really wants to cut them. This is Harris's word salad. And frankly, the rest of the description there of what she's going to do to strengthen and bring down the cost of healthcare is not much better. So I'm going to read you the crucial part. Vice President Harris will make affordable healthcare a right, not a privilege. Okay. So a right. And how does that work? Is this going to be a constitutional amendment? Are you going to, like, how do, just the provisionally, what is your plan there? If you've got, this is not my metaphor. I think Kevin Williamson described it this way, used this years ago, but like, you got five people and you got two apples and you say an apple for every person is a right. Well, that doesn't get you an apple for every person. It's just it's a dumb declaration of nothing. And I think that's what this is here, right? So it's healthcare is a right, not a privilege. By expanding and strengthening the Affordable Care Act, making permanent the Biden-Harris tax credit enhancements that are lowering healthcare premiums by an average of $800 a year for Americans and blah, 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 the insulin stuff, right? But like basically she's going to keep the Biden policy towards taking Obamacare and spending more on it. And that is the best way to think about what Biden has done on healthcare policy is all throughout these bills that he has passed, there have been these sort of top-ups to Obamacare to make it so that there are more subsidies, so that people who are earning a little bit over the initial threshold of 400% of the poverty line, which is about $100,000 a year for a family of four, that those people are going to get subsidized private health insurance if they're not getting it through their jobs as well. And Harris is like, well, we're going to do that, and instead of doing it on a 2 or 3 year temporary basis each time, we're going to make that permanent. We're going to spend more. We're going to keep spending more, and that is our plan for making healthcare cheaper, is to spend billions and billions of dollars more on subsidies. I'm sure it'll work great.
Nick, what did you find in there of interest?
Follow up briefly on Peter's kind of rhetorical demolition of Harris's whole thing, her plan is called A New Way Forward, which is lazy beyond belief. I mean, she might as well just have like Latin letters in there. But I'm in favor of something that she talked about, although I think it shines a light on an interesting dynamic happening in a post-Roe America. She swears to restore and protect reproductive freedoms and kind of goes through a bunch of the horror stories that came up after Roe versus Wade was overturned in the Dobbs decision, and a bunch of states started passing automatically kicked in really restrictive abortion laws and other things, as well as a bunch of Republicans talking about IVF as a problem that they're going to deal with if Trump gets elected. She says, among other things, that any bill to create a national ban on abortion, she would not allow, and that she would sign a national bill for abortion, which of course could have been put into place or brought before Congress anytime after Roe, but never was. But I think what's interesting is, first off, this is something I agree with her on. I think that abortion should be widely available, certainly through viability. Everywhere in the country, it shouldn't depend on what state you're in. But what's interesting to me is that Donald Trump has already, and he did this in the first debate with Biden, he said, you know what, it's being decided by the states, which is what people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg wanted. And there's going to be some states that do it this way and other states that do it another way. He's also backed away from anything having to do with IVF. And he shut up J.D. Vance, who at various points seemed to be against IVF. So what we're seeing is a new consensus after Roe was overturned and pro-life people got what they wanted. It's now, it seems like, something is going to be instantiated that's going to be much more difficult to ever change because most people want access to abortion, at least through viability.
Rhetorical consensus, to be sure, not actual lived in reality consensus that is the law that everyone lives under.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
We now have a political consensus on X. But you still are committing a crime if you have or deliver an abortion within X number of weeks in several states.
And I think what we're going to see within the next couple of years is that the laws that were more extreme on that are going to be really reeled back. And what you're going to have is a much more settled consensus. When Roe was the law of the land, people could keep saying, oh, well, this should be decided at the state level, because pro-life people thought they had the votes at the state level. And it's turning out increasingly that they're not. But again, to go back to something that I guess Catherine was saying, it's, Harris and Trump, there's more in common with them on a lot of stuff than there is like really stark differences, which is disturbing from a libertarian point of view, but interesting from a kind of post-America high point.
The other thing, very briefly, that they have in common is they are not, neither of them are details people. And so, you know, some of the top line stuff comes from a different angle or sounds a little different, but someone else will be in charge of actually writing the text. Someone else will be in charge of actually figuring out implementation. And so that kind of bounces us back to the situation where what matters far more than who's in the top seat might be, you know, who are the cabinet picks? How do we end up kind of staffing and running executive agencies? Because that's where the real lawmaking is going to happen. Harris has no idea how to make many of the planks in her policy proposals occur, and neither does Trump.
Since Catherine talked about Harris's childcare plan, I would just encourage all listeners to this podcast to go and attempt, I say attempt because it will be a challenge, attempt to read verbatim the full quote that Trump gave when he was asked about what he was going to do about childcare. And it is the most salady of word salads that I have ever encountered in my life.
You haven't apparently been a stoner in college at 3 o'clock in the morning in a dorm room.
No, I waited till I was in my 20s for that.
I guess. See, that's it. Speaking of lack of details, I read Kamala's foreign policy section, which is called Stand With Our Allies, Stand Up to Dictators, and Lead on the World Stage. And I kind of don't really even need to add anything. You can hear everything from there. She's ready to be commander in chief on day one. So got that going for her.
That is like the policy equivalent of like champagne for my real friends and real pain for my sham friends. Like,
Catherine, you will always stand up for American interests in the face of China's threats.
Yeah. Yep. That too.
There's an unwavering commitment to South Korea in the face of North Korean threats.
You know what? I wonder if she's getting paid.
Korean
she's getting paid by
operation.
The Koreans for that.
Definitely prefers Ukraine to Russia. Yeah. Is going to ensure NATO is stronger than ever. Will protect
along with the healthcare costs.
Yeah,
we're going to strengthen the healthcare costs
and NATO
and NATO in the Ukraine.
And we're going to protect U.S. forces and interests from Iran and Iran-backed terrorist groups. So that's all exciting. It's a total like a blank slate. Fatigued Atlanticism from a bygone era. Yes, Nicholas?
Who do you think would be better in terms of foreign policy, Trump or Harris?
I don't know. I think that's an impossibly broad brush to paint. I think that...
Who was better, Trump or Biden, on foreign policy?
Why do you want to reduce my entire brain to an up or down toggle question about national politics, unless you are part of the problem?
I am part of the problem, but I'm part of the solution.
I think that possibly the most destabilizing policy idea in this election is Trump's idea of an across-the-board 10 or 20% tariff, and that he thinks he can tariff his way to childcare and tariff this and tariff that. Doug Burgum, surrogate, went on the weekend chat shows and said, when someone does bad trade against it, we'll tariff them, they'll tariff us, and that way we're going to get to free trade. This is a wide growing idea in both parties, but it's accelerating on the one party that used to be more against that kind of talk. And I think if you look at the history of the world, including in the last 100 years, when you have periods of global national populism involving lots of tariffs, it doesn't really lead to very good outcomes, is the traditional way of doing things. So that's part of my answer, but I try not to live my life in a Manichaean type of way and think about a lot of different things.
Oh,
let's
God.
Each
what a cop out, but
cop
yeah,
out.
Sure.
Like you've been trying for 7 years to say, yeah, sure. Isn't Trump better? And my answer is no.
I'm not
going to answer
that
question.
You who I thought was better.
Let's each talk about a question that we would ask each candidate at this debate if Nick Gillespie was the moderator. You can ask Kamala one and Donald Trump one. Go.
Me first.
Yeah.
My answer is, why won't Matt Welch answer Manichaean questions? I'll throw it out there. And also Tim Walz can answer because I assume he's going to be on stage with Kamala, right?
Just sort of nodding up and down.
As a footstool. Yeah. I would ask them, what is the biggest difference you see between you and your opponent when it comes to trade policy and immigration policy? Because Kamala also went into this fog of like, I'm going to be super strong in the border and eventually we're going to fix immigration and make it great. But it's exactly like Donald Trump's kind of perspective, which is that everything is happening at the border. The border is immigration, and we have to deal with that. And that's just such a mistake and a misfocus. I would like to hear them talk about that. And also, again, you know, Trump has actually moderated on certain immigration policies. And I'm curious if she also would go with the idea of giving recent associate's degree holders, BAs, MAs, PhDs, a provisional green card upon graduation from one of our fine American institutions of higher education.
Catherine, you're the moderator. Go.
I would, I guess, desperately try, even though I know that it would almost certainly be a failure, to get them to talk in some meaningful way about the debt. The best version of a question that I can think of would be to just straight up say, do you think the national debt matters at all? And if so, do you have any plans for reducing it? Because I think that it's possible at this stage in the game that one or both of them might answer that they don't think it matters. Like, yeah, and that would be helpful to know. You know, I have long suspected.
I mean, Trump has actually been talking about this in his particular and dumb way, which is that as with the last couple of times he ran, he has been promising to eliminate the deficit through tariffs.
Right.
Well, absolutely no sense at all. It's not clear that he understands the difference between the budget deficit and the trade deficit. But he does say, look, I have a plan. He does not, to be clear. But he says, I have a plan to get rid of the deficit. We won't have deficits that are meaningful anymore. And I'm going to do it through the one policy that I have that will fix everything. It'll pay off the debt and the deficits, and it'll pay for childcare and all the rest of it. It's going to be tariffs. And so he does say it matters, and he does say that he has a plan to fix it. It's just a complete horseshit plan.
I do think when Donald Trump talks about tariffs, especially tariffs on China, he's using it in exactly the same way that a certain type of Democrat uses tax the billionaires. Like, it's like a kind of catch-all that, like, is vaguely revenue generating, that can pay for anything and is punitive toward the group we hate the most, and actually is, like, completely useless as an actionable policy item.
All the costs will fall on someone else.
Peter, what are your questions?
So my question would be to Kamala Harris, and it would be about tariffs. And so I would go back to her North Carolina policy speech, and when she started to outline her agenda, it was built around the idea of an affordability agenda for middle-class families. And she talks about all these things that she's going to do to bring down costs. She actually doesn't really talk all that much about the specifics of what she's going to do. But she says over and over again, I'm going to bring down costs. And then she says, now compare what Donald Trump plans to do. So let's actually do the comparison here. According to Kamala Harris, he wants to impose what is in effect a national sales tax on everyday products and basic necessities that we import from other countries that will devastate Americans. She's talking about his tariffs there. So my question would be, Vice President Harris, the Biden-Harris administration kept virtually all of Trump's original tariffs in place and then raised additional tariffs. How is it that those are not already devastating Americans? And would you keep those policies in place if you were president?
Nicely done. My two questions. One would be similar to that, to Trump, is were the Smoot-Hawley tariffs good or bad, and why or why not? And then to Kamala Harris, how could the federal government possibly know what the price of groceries should be better than grocery stores? Be interesting to get that. All right, we're going to turn this.
By the way, you know who raised tariffs throughout the 20s? A Mr. Calvin Coolidge. I just want you to think about that, Matt Welch.
Are you saying he's the real villain of World
War
II?
That's the answer.
Yeah. We're going to get to our listener
email. I'm pretty sure
that
Calvin Coolidge was,
the week here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor over at the University of Chicago. Friends, in an election year, it's all too easy to get overwhelmed by the constant buzz of news and opinions. Understanding the true impact of political events can be a challenge. Have we got a podcast for you. Not Another Politics Podcast from the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy provides clear, research-driven perspectives on the biggest issues of the day, week, season. Get the insights you need to truly understand the political landscape. No spin, just facts. Subscribe today at harris.u. Harris.U? Yes, harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. They're making me read all these things. It's like, this makes sense to me. Just like, give me the URL, people. That's harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Conversely, you can just look for Not Another Politics Politics wherever you acquire your podcasts. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, please send your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Dave Hood, who writes, "Dear Roundtablers, I understand that the newborn USA funded its government with tariffs. Doubtless, this was the path of least resistance in a number of dimensions, including the fact that the American Revolution was, to some extent, a tax revolt, and that an income tax was unconstitutional back then. In the days of mercantilism, unintended economic consequences may have been considered features rather than bugs. Fast forward to today, where libertarians correctly point out the negative aspect of tariffs, but what if we were to recast tariffs explicitly as taxes?" I'm sensing a theme, by the way, on this podcast. "An advantage of this approach would be that they are deeply regressive, which helps create political pressure to reduce them. A disadvantage will be that they don't replace any of the existing taxes. They merely add to the overall burden. But one way or another, the debt hole will have to be filled and filled with taxes." Thoughts, Catherine?
If I am forced to choose between a variety of types of taxes, would not put tariffs at the top of that list, for all the very reasons that the mercantilists would have considered features and I consider bugs. You know, this is a pretty old classic from like 1990s and aughts libertarians to say, if we have to have taxes, let's have them be consumption taxes. And I guess I associate myself with that. Along with, if we're pulling from that era, just a little flat tax energy. Like, remember those? Remember that stuff?
Put it on a cue card.
We're going to fill out our taxes on an index card. We were all going to pay 17% or whatever it was and just call it a day. I still think there's actually a lot to be said for both of those proposals, but I appreciate that the question asker correctly noted that any new form or newly energized form of taxation would almost certainly be and instead of or. And for that reason, I oppose all of them.
Peter, are tariffs theft?
Look, the relevant portion of this question is, but what if we were to recast tariffs explicitly as taxes? And the quote I read you in that question to Harris shows that that is exactly what she's doing, but she's doing it only for Donald Trump's tariffs. And it's just absurd. It's also, I think, not, I don't think it is doing her much good in terms of winning winning over voters. She is winning over some economists and business leaders that way, people who really are quite afraid of the tariff proposal. But it is, this is being done, or it's at least being done by one party. This is a way that this has been done by economists for years. I mean, there's the famous shirt, right? It's almost like tariffs. Anyway, whatever. I don't remember Catherine. Do you remember the whole shirt?
Failed to achieve their political ends, but also create dysfunction along the way. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a whole thing from Scott Lincecum at Cato about this. And it's correct, and we will keep doing it because describing tariffs as taxes is accurate and a good way to capture their effect on normal people. But I don't know that describing them as taxes actually wins you the battle against tariffs, because because that's been done for a long time, and it seems like everybody wants more tariffs.
Tariffs not only impose immense economic costs, but also fail to achieve their primary policy aims and foster political dysfunction along the way.
That is all you need to know about tariffs. It's perfectly accurate, and sadly, no one cares.
I have it on a t-shirt.
Nick, how do you respond to the emailer's question?
I think it's a great idea to raise the issue of tariffs and put them in the context of, this is something that costs you more when you buy something. You know, call it a tax, call it a tariff. I've been thinking a lot over the past couple of weeks about the way that the battle for free trade was won in the 90s, or by the end of the 90s. And globalization, you know, when it comes to things like the World Trade Organization, the effect of China on the economy, cheap goods at Walmart, et cetera, we need to, you know, remake and win those arguments again, because a lot of people do think that the influx of cheap Chinese crap, which many of us call like the very stuff of life, has made American jobs disappear and things like that. So, yeah, let's call tariffs taxes. Let's talk about why tariffs are bad. And also let's talk about why free trade is good and why it took thousands of years for humanity to get to a point where we had relatively low tariffs and people are doing much better because of that.
My answer to the question is don't change language. I'm not a big fan of like trying to George Lakoff your way through winning.
Now I'm thinking
arguments.
Of an elephant.
And instead, just, you know, describe what a tariff is. And if the thing that you're saying is that it makes everything more expensive, you could say that pretty quickly too, because they do make everything more expensive. And we're living at a time where people are very conscious of stuff costing more. And so be the politician, the political party, the commentator who advocates for stuff costing less. And I think that's a popular thing to say, and you don't have to conflate words that don't mean exactly the same thing as one another. All right, let's get to kind of a lightning round thing. Last week, charges Hunter Biden, President Joseph Robinette Biden II's son, the living son, he pled guilty to all nine charges of tax evasion that he was up for, kind of a surprise plea deal. Not even a deal, he just pled. And this comes after he was convicted earlier this year on three gun-related charges, all of which is when he was behaving very badly as a crackhead. And meanwhile, in not related at all, but also kind of interesting and timely news, a judge delayed the sentencing of Donald J. Trump on his 34 counts of doing the one thing involving hush money and Stormy Daniels. That is delayed now, the sentencing of his conviction, until November 26th, which, as far as we can tell, is going to be after the presidential election. Let's just go around and get a basic whatever the hell anyone thinks about these latest legal developments and what that says about the America that we're all trying to live in. Catherine, why don't you start us?
I guess it just takes us back to our conversation about the Farrah stuff earlier, which is like, it's hard to not say, gee, a lot of these timelines seem like they might be influenced by the timing of the election. Like, that's probably not an ideal way for our judicial system to function. Just
to gain and maintain or extend legitimacy in people's eyes at a time of deep distrust. Peter, what do you say?
Good God, what a mess.
Yeah. Nick, thoughts, Adrin, to add?
Nothing really. I'll be happy when we no longer talk about this stuff.
Yeah. Good luck with all of that. Basically,
I still got a lot of Roger Clinton articles I'm reading, you know, from the 90s.
It's a fun rabbit hole to go down to the most embarrassing presidential siblings and family fallouts in an era that, like, there's going to be competing T-shirts of like distant relative with the same last name against presidential and vice presidential candidate. Love all of it. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
All right. Speaking of presidentially connected vermin, I read Ask Not the Kennedys and the Women They Destroyed by Maureen Callahan. And I want to recommend this if you despise John Kennedy, and if you are not a fan of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and all of the Kennedys in between, this is the book for you. It is a well-documented horror show of just how awful the Kennedy men were. And it's not even necessarily against women, just terrible human beings. There is a subculture, I think, in my experience, although it's fading a bit, of Irish Catholics who, you know, 95% venerate JFK. I grew up in a place in a time where almost every house in my hometown, if you were Irish Catholic, had a picture of JFK standing like in front of the moon. And then there was the legend, that's not what you, you know, your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Right up there with Jesus, Joseph, and Mary. And this is the revenge or the return of the repressed. And it's a good book, not simply because of the Kennedy stuff, but it's a reminder of how power You know, people who have power get away with things that are really awful, and they get treated differently. And the stories that are in this are worth rehearsing for that reason.
Catherine, what did you consider?
I read The Ministry of Time by Kayleigh-Ann Bradley, which is it's a time travel book that's also a kind of workplace bureaucracy book, which is my favorite. So I just wanted to recommend it to you. It's got the same vibes as Isaac Asimov's End of Eternity. It's got the same vibes as This Is How You Lose the Time War. And it's quite good. So this particular one has a conceit in which a few people who were about to die anyway are snatched from their own timelines and brought into ours so that we can study them for reasons that, of course, are, you know, obscured at the beginning of the book and become gradually clearer. Just kind of a great, like, buddy comedy, they were roommates type plot situation, and breezy and well-written. So for those who love a time heist, The Ministry of Time. Also for those who love, once again, always, always, just a little reminder that your various government bureaucracies with global or intertemporal designs will almost certainly screw it up. This book is for you.
Peter, what
Mary Jo Kopechne is not one of the people who saved, is she?
No, yeah, they...
That would have been good.
No.
Peter, what did you consume?
I watched Rebel Ridge on Netflix. This movie is the rarest of things. It is a rip-roaring, kick-ass action movie about public policy. Specifically, it is about civil asset forfeiture and municipal funding corruption. Yes, this is a civil asset forfeiture revenge film, and it freaking rules. And I say that not just because it panders extremely specifically to me. This is a little bit of Jack Reacher here, a little bit of Taken, quite a bit of Rambo, the first one, because it is about a former Marine who is carrying a bag of cash to the courthouse to bail out a family member who is in jail on drug charges. And the local cops just knock him off of his bicycle, take the money that he's carrying, and they say, well, we can just take this because we suspect that it's drug-related. And this is, in fact, how civil asset forfeiture works. And so things then escalate. And they escalate further as our Marine hero tries every peaceful, reasonable, like decent, normal person way of getting his money back and his family member out of jail. And it doesn't work. And it keeps not working. And eventually he has to go to his contingency plan. And his contingency plan is he's a former Marine. And he's a very special kind of former Marine. He taught the other Marines how to de-escalate and deconflict, like basically how to de-arm any person using your body. And so you see then this, like, he basically wages a one-man war on the local police department, which turns out to be engaged in this vast corrupt scheme to do civil asset forfeiture, to fund the government and, like, buy all of their weapons and, like, all this stuff. There's this whole bit about, like, all the fancy toys that they're buying with civil asset forfeiture. This is all stuff from Reason Magazine. This is everything that we have covered. And the final action scene is him. He breaks into the weapons locker. And he gets out, I'm going to spoil it just a little bit, but he gets out all of the, there's a whole bit about the police chief, the bad guy police chief is played by Don Johnson, who is just perfectly slimy and sleazy. And he explains, well, you know, we're not allowed to call them non-lethal weapons for legal, for liability purposes. We've got to call them less lethal. And so our hero breaks in and gets out all of the less lethal weapons and uses them against the police force. And it is just so wonderful and just like a really great, tense, perfectly paced thriller. I would say it moves a little bit slowly and methodically. This isn't a movie that opens with giant action scenes, but it just ratchets up the tension. And if you're going to watch this and you're like not quite sure, wait till about minute 35, because this is where the act break happens. And there is a standoff that happens 35 minutes in that is maybe the single most satisfying scene I have seen in a movie this year. It is just incredible. You watch it and like I was sitting there and I was just like pumping my fist on the couch in my basement. I was so happy about this movie. movie. It's really well done. It's very smart. It is an explainer on civil asset forfeiture and municipal funding corruption. It is as if Reason Magazine designed and funded and put together an action movie. Rebel Ridge on Netflix. Cannot recommend it enough.
All right. I had the pleasure of, while I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania recently, to go to the Andy Warhol Museum. Andy Warhol is from Pittsburgh, Ruthenian Slovak extraction. It is a marvelous museum, and I dare say it's marvelous even if you are not a huge Andy Warhol fan. But, I mean, who really isn't an Andy Warhol fan at some level? I want to just put in a word for the perfectly sized museum. Because I, in my mind, and it could be idiosyncratic, this to me is that. It is 6 floors, but not a huge building. You start at the top and work your way down kind of chronologically through his life as a kid, as a commercial illustrator in New York, which is just lovely, lovely, like drawings of ladies' shoes and such. And then through all the stuff that is more familiar through the factory and his film career, which I couldn't be less interested in. There are always going to be parts of the Warhol story and history that you can kind of check out of. I don't know if everyone loves his urine paintings, for example, but there's plenty of other stuff to look at and things that you might not have known about. Since I am a child, my favorite part of the entire thing was a room, I think it's called the Silver Clouds Exhibition, where it's just like a room with black walls and like these gigantic free-floating and kind of blown slowly through the air silver balloons, and you get to go poof and poof and kind of like do that. It's great, man. Just really great, and like it lasts the perfect amount of time, like, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. You walk through, it's just well contained, you know, like the Rodin Museum in Paris or the John Soane, I think it is, museum in London. Just that perfect size. You don't leave feeling like, damn it, I wish I could have gone to the third floor. Anyways, it's just really great. It's post-war America art and culture and life and just really, really fun. Nick, I presume you've been there.
I have, and it actually renewed my interest in Andy Warhol, because it is exactly as you say, it's like a real, you kind of walk through his life and art and whatnot. And the other thing, I don't know if you did this, but, or if they still do, because I was there about 10 years ago, you could do a screen test.
Yeah, I chose not to because I just don't care at all about his movie stuff for whatever reason.
What's interesting about the screen tests that he did, which were about 3.5 minutes long or something like that, it was the length of a film cartridge where he would just sit people down who were famous and not give them any direction. And you just see the celebrity persona kind of melt away once people don't know what to do with themselves. And they had a big archive of them there. It's really fascinating. And it's the beginning of, in many ways, of a very important continuing strain of contemporary media, which is that people have very, you know, we can manipulate our images more than ever, but we can also, you know, get trapped in that more easily and unmasked as kind of phony. Really fascinating. But yeah, I agree with you completely. It's a great museum.
Speaking of trapped, we hope to trap you on the rest of our website, including our podcasts, reason.com/podcasts. Have several of them now, including debuted last week. And this week we have season two, episode two of Why We Can't Have Nice Things with Eric Boehm. The first one featured Mark Cuban talking about drug prices. The new one on Thursday will be about certificate of need laws, which is going to be a Don Johnson active revenge thriller, hopefully in 2 or 3 years. If you know what certificate need laws are, you're probably already getting your blood pressure up. If you don't, tune in to find out why you should be mad at them and who's dying because of them. It's terrible. Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Eric Boehm, new episode Thursday, etc. We have a lot of events, including, I think, at the Reason office. Catherine, what are you eventing this week?
There is a party at the Reason office today in anticipation of, this is Monday, in anticipation of debate week, which we are currently in. Not only the debate that Harris and Trump will be having, but also the debate that is hosted by the Free Press and FIRE, which I will be participating in. They are back to back. My debate which I am debating with Tyler Cowen and against David Leonhardt and Bhaskar Sunkara, starts at 7. The presidential debate starts at 9. You can do both on Tuesday. But first, you should come to the Reason office to party tonight if you hear this in time.
Basically, Catherine's inviting you to start drinking now,
yes, in it,
like a full day before the Harris-Trump debate starts.
I hope to not be sober until the Trump-Harris debate is over tomorrow night.
Nick, what do you got going in New York City?
In New York City on Wednesday, September 11th, this Wednesday, we've got a great live interview with Kat Timpf, who's got a new book out about binary thinking and why that divides us. You can go to reason.com/events and you can buy tickets for that. It comes with beer, wine, food, and conversation.
Awesome. Hope everyone survives this debate week, and we will catch you next Monday. Goodbye. Boof and boof.